Good morning, everyone. My name is Melanie Dorian. I'm the New South Wales e-learning coordinator for the Australian Flexible Learning Framework, and I'm delighted to welcome you to e-learning 09, Engaging E-Learners Conference. And I hope that over the next few days, you find some great opportunities for networking, for information sharing, and for learning whatever it is that you are most passionate about in the field of e-learning. I would like to hand over now to Simon Payne. Simon is the New South Wales representative on the Flexible Learning Advisory Group, or FLAG. FLAG has the responsibility for implementing the Australian Flexible Learning Framework strategy nationally, and there is a representative from every state and territory and from the federal government who fund the framework on that advisory group, and they are the ones who set the strategic direction. Every 3 to 4 years, the strategic direction is renewed, and in the current framework, which goes from 2008 to 11, the focus is on embedding e-learning. So I'd like to hand over now to Simon. Thanks, Simon.
Thank you. Good morning. I'd like to begin by paying my respects to the traditional owners of this land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and to their leaders past and present, and to Aboriginal people here today. I'm very pleased to see some familiar faces amongst the audience, but I'm even more delighted to see some new faces amongst the audience, which just means, I think, that we are extending the framework community far and wide. So thank you all for attending, and welcome to eLearning 09. Is it really 12 months since we last met? Time flies when you're in the middle of a digital education revolution. And of course, in the vocational education and training space, we all know that's been going on a little longer. And this year's benchmarking survey nationally now shows that the e-learning uptake stands at 39% nationally. And in New South Wales alone, that's grown by 7% in 2009, which is a pretty good effort. Interestingly, that survey shows that 35% of employers now use e-learning for workforce development. Two-thirds of employers think that e-learning is flexible and efficient and would recommend it to their employees and to other employers. And from a student perspective, 90% of our students would like at least a little e-learning in their course. And I think this is a great statistic. 59% of students thought that e-learning in their course would improve their employment outcomes, either in jobs that they might be looking for or in promotional opportunities in the job that they're in. So I think that's a terrific signal for us in e-learning. And for those of you not familiar with the benchmarking survey, and those of you interested in expanding your business, there are some really good pointers to what our customers are looking for in that benchmarking survey, so I'd thoroughly recommend it. So in up, we must be doing something right. And I think what we do in the VET sector is to truly collaborate and share and actually deliver results. And this was recognised this year by the OECD study tour, which looked at systemic innovation in education and training and singled out the flexible learning framework as one of the few examples of national collaboration over a sustained period. So we were very pleased from a FLAG perspective with that result. And I think that reflects on everyone that's been involved in the framework over the last three iterations. So well done, everybody. And it is, I think, recognised nationally as one of the few national frameworks that actually works in Australia, so we're very pleased with that as well. You'll have an opportunity over the next 2 days to continue building that culture of sharing and collaboration, and you'll have the opportunity to share in the stories of change experienced by both practitioners and organisations represented at eLearning 09. And these stories reflect how they are meeting the emerging needs of their customers. The theme of our conference is engaging e-learning, and we're very fortunate to have with us as our keynote speaker, Cathy Moore, who for more than 25 years has used technology in a creative and lively way to help people learn. And these days, she helps people supercharge their instructional design skills, and she designs and writes e-learning for businesses. She's an arch collaborator and a passionate sharer, so in short, she's actually one of us. And I noted on her website, someone described her as turning the ho-hum into ha-ha. And I think there'd be many people in this room, Cathy, that would settle for that as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Cathy Moore.
Thank you, Simon. Good morning, everybody. I know this is listed as a keynote, and you may be expecting for me to dazzle you with slick slides and a lot of talk, and you get to just absorb it. But the way I do a keynote, you have to talk. So just be prepared, drink some coffee if necessary. Look, we lost the slideshow. Try that. So luckily for us, this is our typical learner, right? All your learners are like this guy, or are they more like her? What causes this? What makes some e-learning boring? Maybe even some e-learning you might have been involved with. What makes e-learning boring sometimes?
Reading.
So too much text.
Lack of engagement.
No communication, like between human beings. Especially not between student and student. What else can send e-learning off the rails? Sense of isolation.
No plan, no map, not knowing where you're going.
No plan, no roadmap of where you're going, either as a designer or as a student, maybe.
No feedback on how you're going.
No feedback on how you're going.
Too much content.
Too much content. I am known for my machete. I chop content. It's my specialty. So some of the things that we've talked about are sort of surface things, like too much text, not enough interaction. For these sorts of things, I'd recommend this book, E-Learning and the Science of Instruction, by Ruth Clark and Richard Meyer, where they summarize what research tells us about how multimedia adds to or makes it easier to learn or makes it harder to learn. So if your team members have the habit of saying, oh, let's spice this up with an animated talking character, you can say, wait, let's just think about this for a minute. Does the research show that having an animated talking character flitting about the screen actually improve learning? So it's a great weapon when you have people suggesting things that you may not totally agree with, but you don't want to say, I don't agree, you need some backup support, this is your book. Or if you're new to e-learning and you want to know what the research says about the types of multimedia, this is your book. I'm pointing you to this book because I'm not going to talk about that aspect of e-learning. I want us to look at the deeper level, the instructional design decisions that go into creating a course. And I'm going to talk specifically about the online material. So whether you're creating a semester-long course that involves all sorts of modalities with some online, or whether you're creating a two-hour totally online asynchronous course, these ideas are directed towards you. So we're talking about instructional design, which I define as the decisions we make to identify the problem we're trying to solve, determine how we're going to solve it, and create an experience for the learner. And it starts with a goal. Start with one goal, and you can create an engaging, memorable experience for your learners. Start with a slightly different goal, and you are on the long, dry road to Dullesville. Let's take a look at that. Here's a learner. She has a business selling flowers. She wants to stay in business. Which of these goals would help her stay in business? Does she need to sell flowers? Or does she need to identify the main principles of the flower selling process? Sell flowers, right? The instructional designers, all of us have an internal instructional designer. And the internal instructional designer might be saying, B, because it's a learning objective and we can assess it. But what happens is we get so focused on what's going on in the learner's head that we can sort of forget what they need to do with that knowledge. Of course, every firefighter needs to be able to describe techniques used to put out a fire. But does knowledge always change behavior? So it's our goal. And unfortunately, traditional education, which a lot of us came out of, the traditional approach is to believe that our goal is to disseminate knowledge, and we equate knowledge with information. So symptoms of this would be a team member saying, let's put this material online. Or, slightly better, we need to make this content more interactive. What are they focusing on here? The content. And they're doing it because this is how they experienced learning. So then they think this is learning. Another way to look at it, That sheet of music on the left, that's information. And if we were designing a course, we would say, this is important information. We're going to put it online. We're going to assess it. We're going to make sure that the person knows this melody. Oh, and when we display it, maybe we should do it like measure by measure. Should we do that? Or should we animate like the slides? That's what we're thinking about. The learner is thinking, I want to play this piece in public. What's the missing piece? What is the bridge that will get us from that information to that performance? What does the learner need to do? He needs to practice. He needs to do it, or she. And this is the big piece that I think is often missing in e-learning. So one of the great advantages of e-learning, an online activity, especially a standalone one where you're doing it in private, is a great way to practice, to play, to mess around, make mistakes, screw up, redo it. You have the freedom to, if you don't understand it, go through it again and again and again without worrying about making somebody impatient. You can redo your mistakes. You can try things that you would be too nervous or embarrassed to try in the real world. Basically, one of the huge strengths of e-learning is that it gives us a sandbox, a safe place to practice. And it's also one of the least acknowledged strengths, in my opinion. We see it as, oh, it's efficient. It's a great way to get a lot of information to a lot of people quickly and assess to make sure that they understood it. A lot of us were missing this bit. When I started out, this is what I thought. I thought my job was to design information because that's how it was presented to me. We have this content, please put it online and make it slightly less dry than it is right now. But the more I did that and the more that I saw more engaging e-learning, I realized that our job is to design an experience for the learner. We can do that because we're using an interactive medium that lets us set up safe virtual places to practice. And by virtual, I don't mean Second Life necessarily. I mean in our imagination even. So instead of saying, let's focus entirely on the content, we need to ask questions like this. What do the learners need to do in the real world, such as put out fires, and how can we help them practice that? And in an ideal world, to me, that those would be the first two questions that we start any project with. Not, we have this course we want to put online. We say, okay, let's step back from that. What do learners really need to do in the real world? Why do we have this course, basically? What do they need to do, and how can we help them practice that? So let's look at an example. This is a convenience store isolated at the city's edge. My government, the U.S., decided that there were too many robberies at these stores and that they would develop an online course for the owners of convenience stores to help them reduce the chances that they would be robbed. So they did this sort of thing. This is an actual course. It's a typical slide. What is workplace violence? Here's some useful bits. Why are we laughing? What's wrong with this slide besides its visual design? It's not plain language. Is it telling us anything we could actually do? No. It's talking in high-level abstractions. Increase the effort that the perpetrator must expend. I love imagining how I could do that. There's another very typical slide, even less focused. There is some slightly useful information there, like keep minimal cash in the register. But again, how? We need to have cash to make change. You know, what are we supposed to do? So instead of looking at that information, let's look at Bob here. Bob is an actual learner. He owns convenience stores. He owns this convenience store, among others. One night he had a 17-year-old girl working at the convenience store, and she faced this. How could those slides of information have prevented this? What we have to do is get beyond the information and look at the real world and what learners need to do. So, with your knowledge of convenience stores, what does Bob need to actually do in the real world, not what does he need to know? What does he need to do? Some people say bulletproof glass, security guards. In the real world, in his store, do a role play? Or what we're going to is we're skipping over the activities right now. We're going straight to what do they need to do in the real world. So it's our task analysis. Change the physical design of the store, maybe to make it obvious to passersby that there's a guy with a gun in there, for example, or to increase the visibility between the cash register and the door. What other things in the real world does he need to do? Something about minimal cash?
more cash. Work it out.
Yeah, figure out how you're going to keep enough cash in the register to make change and lock the rest away. Employ people who know what they're getting into, and if you do employ teenagers, don't put them on the overnight shift. So we came up with a lot of ideas. And this is the kind of thinking that, for some reason, people involved in instructional design are not expected to do. It's like we're supposed to believe when our sponsor says, we need a course in X, and here's what it needs to cover. We go, okay, how do I make it more interactive? And what I'm saying is we need to go back to that person and say, but why? What is it that people need to do in the real world? And what material that you're giving me actually supports that? So we came up with a lot of ideas. For example, one of our ideas was examine the site for security risks. Seems like a very basic first step. He needs to go around and do sort of a security audit of his store. How could we, remember our second question? After what do they need to do in the real world, we ask, how can we help them practice that? How can we help Bob practice examining aspects of his site for security risks? Practice it online in a realistic way. Any ideas? Scenarios? A checklist with a photo of a real store. Yeah, we're looking for realistic. I'm sorry? An animation of showing somebody do it. That could be a useful introduction to people who are brand new. I always go for make them do it. Plunge them into an activity. So we've got a mock-up here. We've made up Mark, who, just like Bob, is a fictional convenience store owner. This is a mock-up of the course. The final one might not look like this. And in the menu on the left, in the teeny tiny type that you can't read, the first thing that happens is we meet Mark. Mark says, hi, just like you, I own convenience stores. Recently, one of my stores was robbed, and as a result, my best worker quit. I need to improve security so this doesn't happen again. Will you help me? So then the setup is that you go to Mark's virtual store, which in this case is just flat JPEGs. It's just photos of a store, and evaluate it the same way that you're going to have to evaluate your own property, using a checklist that we have created for you and that you download and use. So we're having the learner download exactly the same kind of policy procedural document learning aid that they will use in the real world, and we're having them use it in a virtual world. And so in this activity, for example, you would click on one of the lights. You'd go to a different image. It would show you what type of light bulb, what time of day it comes on, how many watts it has, and you would compare that to what is recommended in that checklist. And then you would tell Mark here, that light has to go because, or this light can stay because. Then, after doing several activities like that, one for lighting, one for the door, others for visibility, the course says, okay, now you go out there in the real world and do exactly what you just did, but on your own stores, using exactly the same checklists that you've downloaded and printed out. And we even have a to-do list to help you organize what you're doing. And if this were something that were going to be assessed for certification, doing it in the real world could have an assessor with him, or he could be taking digital photos of what he's doing as proof of what he's doing. And I have just this little fantasy at the end where if you had questions, you could actually contact a human being, but that's not a possibility in the original course. So we went from an organization focused on information. The original course started out with all sorts of definitions. What is OSHA? You know, who are the authors of this course? What is workplace violence? What are the risk factors of being in the business that you're in? It took a long time to cut to the chase, and when it did, as you saw, there wasn't really any useful information. What we've done instead is we have organized it entirely around activities. You increase visibility in the fictional store, learn ways to secure the building, choose alarms, and learn about scheduling employees. So we've gone from a stream of information that often would be ended with a quiz or assessment, and instead we've gone from activity to activity to activity. The learner experiences this not as information followed by a quiz, but as a series of activities, and each activity contains the bare minimum information that it really needs to succeed. So like if that first hand up there, the lighting activity, that little information bubble represents the lighting checklist. It's not on the screen. It's not something we expect you to read and take a quiz about. It's a checklist that you use during the activity. And these activities, depending on many things, these activities could be your assessment. Okay? So if Bob the learner is going through Mark's lighting evaluation online, your LMS is tracking what he says, the LMS is saying, Bob is bombing this part. You know, heads up. That gives you important information. So it's not necessarily these are a stream of practice activities and then there's an assessment, unless that's how you are required to do your courses. I know some of you are. So basic point, design the activities first. This is a variation on the instructional design approach, design the assessment first. Then decide what information is needed. And then provide that information in its most concise, useful form and in a form that's going to be as similar as possible to how they will use it in the real world. Which brings up audience. The example that I just gave you has a very tightly focused, well-defined audience. People who own convenience stores. And because we're the government, we have a lot of statistics on these people. We know how old they are, what level of education they have. I know that a lot of you have much broader audiences, and you're supposed to cover much more stuff. Like if you have a social work course, it might supposed to apply to people who are reading at a sixth grade level up through people who could write the Encyclopedia Britannica, people who live in the country, people who live in the city, people who are going to be living in the city, working in the country, people who are going to be working with the elderly mostly, people who are going to be working mostly with another group, and somehow you're supposed to cover them all with this one course. And this reminds me of a story that I learned in marketing. Some people like really hot coffee. Different people like iced coffee. If you wanted to come up with a coffee product that would please everyone, then of course you would sell room temperature coffee, right? That's what's happening when we try to make one online course cover a huge, broad audience and a huge range of possibilities. So to make this easier on yourselves, if at all possible, it's good to be able to say to those who are giving you this task, look, we can't do it effectively if it's supposed to be everything for everyone, because then it turns into this generic information dump. If you can't tell them that, then I would suggest chunking it down, saying, okay, let's do an activity for the people who will be working in the country. The people who will be working in the city, they can skip it, as opposed to trying to come up with an activity that would be equally applicable for everyone. So that's another solution, is to give your learners some optional paths through the material. Of course, it adds to design time. But everything I'm talking about adds to design time, because often our design is put the information online. Another thing, that this example with the convenience stores, very concrete behaviors we wanted from Bob. We wanted him to go out with a checklist, look at things and make changes, go to the hardware store, buy an alarm, and install in a door. What if your content isn't so concrete? Does anybody have an example of a course covering something that doesn't have that kind of real-world behavior? Induction, which would be greeting new employees?
Orientation
for new employees.
There's organizational charts and history.
Yeah, the history of our organization. How we do things here and why. Okay, what are the real world behaviors that we expect as a result of this course? There are some. They may be sort of negative. There may be a behavior that we're trying to avoid. One of the behaviors I think would be stick around for a while. Now that we've hired you, if you quit right away, it costs us like $30,000 to replace you. So that could be one of the actions that we want the learner to take. Stick around. Another could be, it's sort of a negative one, don't pester your coworkers with lots of clueless questions, because we have a business to run here, man. So independently deal with a lot of the basics, because our course has been so great, it's taught you that. What are some other real-world behaviors that an induction course is designed to create?
Conformity.
Conform. Don't stick out. Don't be a problem. Definitely. Meld into our culture. That's a little trickier, obviously, than go to the hardware store and buy a door alarm. But I like to say that every course can be seen in terms of behaviors in the real world. And if they aren't totally concrete behavior, like swinging a hammer, then it's a decision that the person is making. A classic example is an ethics course. because the actions, the real-world actions, may actually be non-actions. The person makes a decision. The person is faced with a dilemma and then makes a decision that's influenced by what they've learned in your course. The decision may be an action or not, but what you've done is you've influenced real-world decisions. And even if we look at the concrete behavior like we've got Bob doing, he is making decisions. A decision precedes that behavior. Oh, I'm going to go to the hardware store and buy a door alarm because I don't have one, and I'm now convinced that I need one. So as you learn more about your learners, if possible, you identify the kinds of decisions that they're making in the real world. Sometimes we're so isolated from our learners, we have to sort of make it up. But if possible, agitate for direct access to the learners and some knowledge of what they really do on the job. You're going to have people on your team that are very fond of the content. And the content is actually appealing because it's so easy. All we have to do is put it online and test them. It's so much easier. How about this slide? Does Bob need to know that he is at risk for robbery because he has contact with the public and that involves an exchange of money? Bob is 40 years old. Is it helpful to know that if he were a cab driver, he would be at risk? No, obviously, that can go. How about this? The course is about people coming in and robbing your store. Do we need this definition of workplace violence? No, it's not a course about workplace violence. If this were a course specifically about violence in the workplace in all its forms and how to deal with it, this would be a useful definition, especially because it makes clear that it includes verbal abuse. But this isn't a course about workplace violence. It's about people coming into your convenience store and robbing you. It's a different thing. How about this? The history of convenience stores. It's fascinating. We could add some pictures of like old convenience stores or like how this one convenience store changed over time. Okay, people are saying no, but what if your boss says, this is fascinating, and I feel that putting fascinating information in the course makes it more appealing? What do you do? Put a link to it. This becomes optional. I had one client that turned this into an art. The main course material was always in the center of the screen, and then at the right side of the screen, they had what they called the marginalia. And the client would say, oh, we've got to put this in here. It's so cool. We'd go, okay, there it is, right there in the marginalia. Always on the screen. People can click on it anytime. And nobody ever did. How about this? A worksite hazard analysis is a step-by-step look at the workplace defined, et cetera, et cetera. A definition of a workplace hazard analysis, which is what we're asking Bob to do as part of this course. Do we need to describe it in these this sort of high-level way? Or do we just give him one to do it? We're saying, Bob, you're going to check the safety of your store, and here's what you need to do. In our sample course, we have a lot of checklists and other materials that Bob is going to download and print out and use in the real world. I'm calling those a job aid. In the education world, it might be a study aid. It's the kind of information that you want to have on hand, easily accessible to use in the real world. So an arbitrary division here is that everything that we need to know instantly in our head goes in the course where we have to memorize it, and everything else, which is a huge proportion of many courses, goes in some sort of external form, and that form is going to be in the form most useful in the real world. So what information does Bob need to actually memorize? Phone number for the security guard, emergency procedures. It seems like he may need to get a few concepts like don't schedule a 17-year-old for the 2 a.m. shift. So basic principles like don't schedule the 17-year-old late and emergency procedures. That's really all that we need to imprint in his brain for eternity and therefore goes in the course as main content. All the rest can go in job aids, what I'm calling job aids, the checklists. And is anybody here familiar with the work of Alison Rossett? She wrote a book entirely on job aids, and she divided them up into two categories. You've got your sidekick, which is your grocery list, or Bob's lighting checklist. It comes with you as you do the task. Then there's the planners. These are helpful bits of information that you look at before you do the task. Like you're a manager and you're about to meet with an employee who is accusing another employee of harassment. And you go, whoa, this doesn't happen often. You get this planner that says, in this kind of meeting, you'll want to, you know, focus on these points, ask these types of questions, don't say this. You look at that beforehand, prepare yourself, and then you go into the meeting. That's a planner. So that's the sort of thing I'm talking about that could be outside the course. We had an activity where we used a lighting checklist. Would this have been a better way to do it, you think? Before we start the activity, we have the learner do some work. Let's see, it says, for this step, you'll need the following. The MDR lighting checklist, version 2B, types of light bulbs for outdoor security use, incidents related to poor lighting in car parks, and we also want Bob to search the web for halogen convenience store lighting and describe what he learns in a document created by Bingo Easy Writer, which is a program that he doesn't have, and he downloads and finds it doesn't work on his operating system. This is an exaggeration, but I have seen a lot of this. What is an argument for this approach? Making the learner go out and get the information. In the real world, you might have to actually go and find that information yourself. Anything else? Some people argue that it involves the learner more in the content because they're having to make critical decisions about the content. Oh, that applies to me and that doesn't apply to me. What I say is it increases extraneous cognitive load. Cognitive load is how hard it is to understand something. Something like physics, for me, has a high intrinsic cognitive load. It's already kind of hard. And if I were in a physics course and I had to run through all those hoops and do all this extra work, that makes it even harder to learn. It's extraneous, outside of the topic, cognitive load. The only time that I would say that this is useful is if, in Bob's field, staying on top of the information is really important. And like if the technology for halogen convenience store light bulbs is rapidly changing, we could say, Bob, any information we would provide you through this course is going to be outdated by the time you read it. You have to go do a web search on, you know, convenience halogen store lighting. But what we've done instead of making Bob run around and do it all, since we're the government anyways, we're telling him what to do. We have made a checklist super concise with everything that we think is most important. So my main points, there is an aspect to online learning that I think is underused, and that is using it as a sandbox, a safe place to practice what you'll be doing in the real world. As educators, as instructional designers, we're often thinking about what goes on in somebody's head. And so we immediately start thinking of learning activities, which could be drag and drops, quizzes, writing essays about things. Unless the person is doing a drag and drop on their job, it's not necessarily the most efficient way to teach them. In the talk I'll be giving tomorrow on using story techniques, that's mostly about scenarios. It's about using scenarios to create realistic activities. I have a link to some research that shows that if you have a realistic scenario, it increases long-term remembering. Quizzes are a test of short-term memory. You just read this fact. Now regurgitate it. A scenario like this, evaluate Mark's lighting, has been shown, when it's realistic, to increase the ability of a person to remember this process, remember this information for a lot longer. So when you're creating a sandbox, we're in that sandbox, we're giving them the opportunity to practice what they're going to be doing in the real world. Ideally, we're creating a series of activities that have embedded seamlessly inside them the minimal information that the activities need. And this is the way to keep the extraneous information out, because you say to the person who wants to add it, this activity is about washing a dog. Do we really need to know the history of dog washing to do this activity? So you focus them on exactly what's going to happen, because our job is to design an experience, not to put information online. This is one of the books I recommended, E-Learning and the Science of Instruction, which is the summary of research about multimedia. I also recommend Michael Allen's Guide to E-Learning. He aims it more at the corporate market, but I think it's useful for everybody. And at the end is my blog, which has a lot more ideas like this and some interactions that help you ask your sponsor or client the necessary questions to get them to confess what it is that the learner really needs to do in the real world. So when they come to you with a stack of information, you can say, but why? Why do you need this information? What problem are we trying to solve? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathy. And I'm sure there's lots of questions.
Hi. Look, I'm working in an environment where we have quite a bit of content that people need to know. And there are some activities. It's higher education. How would you look at designing something that involved people learning content?
I would look at each bit of content and say, why do they need to use to learn this? How are they going to be using this? Is this some, or is this just purely like introduction to biology kinds of things? Is this a vet sector one? Or?
No, this is not vet sector. This is accredited higher education courses.
Yeah, that's totally outside my realm, basically. I left academia and went to the corporate side because I like the focus on getting on real-world behaviors. And you have the challenge, as you are saying, that you are supposed to get information into people's brains for possible use maybe, and you don't know what they're how they're going to be using it, so then that becomes a real challenge. Sorry.
Okay, I've got a question over here. In terms of language, have you had any involvement in teaching language with what you've been doing, Kathy?
Teaching, like, English as a second language or teaching...
We're actually teaching an Indigenous language, mm-hmm. which had been lost almost, as mm-hmm. being revitalised. And so in the real world, there's not that much opportunity to really practice it, but, you know, in growing that with families and friends and getting that, learning that language. So our challenge is, yeah, how to make that real when the real world doesn't really, you know, it's just something we're needing to grow.
That can be a fun challenge, because then we can make up an imaginary online world in which people do speak that language. And that, I think, plays to one of the great strengths of online activities, because we can say, here, we've created a world in which people around you do actually speak that language. Speak it to them.
Yeah, we're actually talking over last night over dinner that maybe what we need to do is have a one-sided conversation, so that, you know, from making a cup of tea, and so they have to then could respond with a variety of choices, so that it starts to become real world. But yeah, mm-hmm. we need to work on more of those.
Is this sort of like a branching scenario? Choose your own adventure. If you ask for a certain kind of tea, you get one response. If you say something else that's actually rude, you get another response. I love those. And that doesn't necessarily need a huge amount of technology to develop. Obviously, with a language course, audio is going to be really important, but not necessarily flash. You don't necessarily have to go to Second Life and create an island in which this language is spoken and go through all of those expensive hoops and expensive long design.
I was just wondering about the lighting checklist thing. It's someone else making the decision about which lights are correct.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it would have to be constantly updated as well. So is that part of... in that design of that, would that be happening, that constant updating?
This would be, the example I gave would be pretty centralized. It's, you know, the voice on high, whether it's the government or the corporation or the vet sector requirements, saying this is what you must do.
Yeah.
And so this is not something creative, this is not exploratory learning, in that there are any number of ways to do this. You go out there and you figure out the best way for you personally. Because this is more, we see a problem, we've defined the problem as this, we see part of the solution being this, and we're going to tell our workers to do it. Yeah,
okay,
that's my
cool.
world.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, thanks, that's good.
We have a question in the front here.
Hi, I was just wondering about feedback, just in that example that you gave, the convenience store. I assume that's a real example.
Before example was the real example, the after is not.
Oh, okay, well, in the after mm-hmm. example, how would the learners get feedback? So they get those checklists and the job aids that you talked about. So in the actual delivery of it, how do they know that they get it right?
Well, the feedback is part of the activity. So if I click on a light in Mark's store and we zoom in on it and the light tells me I'm a 200-watt halogen bulb, I come on at 1 in the morning and I illuminate 1 square meter of parking lot. I, as the learner, will look at my checklist thinking, you know, I think that light's underpowered. It needs to come on earlier, needs to be brighter. And so I'm telling the software that, you know, I say, fail on this light. And then maybe the next question is, why did you fail this light? And then I have to either type or choose the reasons why I think this light needs to be changed. So your LMS or whatever tracking system you have, or the instructor, is getting this feedback from the learner. Then the learner is getting feedback from the activity. For example, if I fail a light that's actually perfectly okay, the activity could say, no, this wattage is actually the government recommended wattage for this light. Look at your checklist. No, step three, whatever. Or, you know, that's right. This light does need to be brighter. So it's just like any online activity where you build in contextual feedback. They make a choice, and either they get feedback or, as I'm going to advocate for tomorrow, they see the results of their actions. So the learner approves a light that is actually too dim. Next thing we see, you know, a bad guy's lurking in the shadows created by that light, something like that. So they can conclude that they made a bad choice. Does that answer your question?
One of the things I think that drives so much content is in online is because it's relatively low cost to create the learning environment. And the more activities you put into the learning environment, the more cost you add into the development. What sort of approaches do you see to overcome this hurdle for many of us here who don't have much money to develop programs?
I would first say that an activity doesn't necessarily have to be more expensive than putting information on the screen, because you can do actually a pretty realistic and impactful activity with a multiple choice text question. So please don't think flash, any of that. Just think, engage the learner's brain in the kinds of decisions that they're going to make in the real world. And make it as realistic as possible using either descriptions of that world or photos from that world. To me, the extra load of this approach comes in the design, the analysis. Okay, what do people really need to do? Because we often skip that. And then the brainstorming. Okay, which of these activities are the highest priority? We need to design activities for those. Which are the actions that are less likely to happen? We can kind of punt those and make those information dumps. It's the design for me that takes longer. It's not necessarily more development time or more development bells and whistles, but it's I need more than the week that some clients give me to do this. I think that also one of the potential challenges too is that a lot of you have, as I said earlier, you have to address this incredibly broad audience that's going to be doing the job in very diverse places. So you have to decide, okay, which are the most likely places? We'll make activities for those. For the least likely places, we may have to just, you know, touch on those in a less appealing way. You know, so you have to make all these trade-offs. Otherwise, you'd be developing, you know, 97 activities to cover every possible contingency. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
Hi, Kathy. The Flexible Learning Framework has a e-learning design tool. I was just wondering if you'd had a chance while you're here to have a look at that and make any comment on it.
Is this the tool that...
Design e-learning.
There's steps that go across the screen. I'm kind of visual, so I'm picturing this. Yes. I had a quick look at it in a session at a city that I now can't remember. And I saw that it was certainly having people focus more on the learners than a lot of us do, and don't remember, is there a part that says, okay, and what do your learners need to do in the real world? What are the tasks they need to perform? Is there a task analysis part in there? Because I didn't remember seeing one. And I think the main comment I had when I saw that was, you know, there's no goal. Where's the goal statement? We need a goal for the project. We need to say this project is designed to prepare X people for employment as a specifically defined job in a certain situation, and there didn't seem to be a goal. And in the corporate world, the goal would be something like, our goal is to increase retention of employees 5% by 2012. You know, we hire somebody, they quit, let's look at our induction training and see if we can't affect that. And so then we set a goal like that.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any more questions? Hi.
Hi.
Where I work, we've been using activity-based approaches or task-based approaches for quite a long time. And one of the things that I struggle with, and I was just interested to hear what your opinion is, is that balance between knowledge and being able to do things. Now, one of the things I worry about is that do we get a whole generation of people with these approaches? We end up having a whole lot of people who run around doing things without sort of fundamental principles driving that, number one. Number two, that we're promoting go and do it, then find out that you're wrong, find out that you're wrong, then learn. Intuitively, I would like to see a balance, but I don't know, I just wondered what you thought.
And you're in the vet sector, you said? Or?
Yes, okay. So that task-based approach is very, you know, it's very applicable, so we do that quite a bit, yeah.
To address the second part of what you said, are we saying go out there and try it and screw it up and then learn? I'd say do that online, not in the real world. So these online activities where you are required to make a decision. Adult learners, as we know, we come to material full of opinions, full of life experience. We think we already know how to do some of this stuff. We shouldn't have to sit through this content, yada, yada, yada. One way to deal with that is to say, hey, here's a decision like you're going to face on this job. What do you do? And then you, as learner, think, well, obviously it's B, and then you find out you're wrong. That, I think, is more educational than having an information dump before that saying, in this situation, you'll want to do X, and then there's an activity where you have to choose X. I think it's more educational to put them in the activity and find out that their assumptions were wrong. That kind of gives them a little wake-up call. I wouldn't say every activity needs to do that because we don't want people screwing up in every activity and thinking, you know, I'm not suited to this job. We need to give them things that they are going to easily answer correctly and ease them into the things where they're going to screw up. As to, is this encouraging a whole generation of people who do without thinking? I wasn't proposing that we just have lists of what they need to do, and like for an invoicing program. Here's how you enter an invoice. You do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, next. No, not that at all. When you design the activity, you also, remember those little information things going into it, you're including not just the procedure, but all the concepts and everything too. Like we talked about, Bob needs to know the concept of don't put a 17-year-old on the overnight shift. So we have to include those things too. And you can design an activity also that makes them analyze the concepts. One thing I like to do is I write a lot of financial courses. For example, in a course on European Economic Community regulations regarding cross-border financial transactions, I could say, Nigel in this bank in London wants to sell this certain type of financial instrument to Pierre in Paris. Can he do it? And you think, well, yeah, he can. And then you say, why? Why is this appropriate? Are you sure there's no risk? And you're thinking, crap, maybe there's a risk here. So you design the activity to reveal the concepts underneath. You know, like the concept underneath this one might be that there's potentially some money laundering going on. So it's just a difference between telling them this is money laundering and what it looks like, which you can do, certainly, but it's, I think, very effective to embed that in the activity to make the thought come to their head rather than planting it in there for them. Is this making sense? And I certainly have seen plenty of training that says this is how you fill out an invoice, step, 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 step. No big picture, no reason why, no information or no concepts about what's ethical and what's not. So I see your point, too. Yeah.
Hi, Kathy. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see the role of social learning in e-learning design, particularly in an age where we're all, sort of all web 2 aware and have all these new technologies available to us in our e-learning design? How do you see the place of it?
I see it as a great place for learners to discuss the kind of conceptual awakenings that we're trying to get to happen through these activities. For example, if you have a realistic activity, an ethics course is an easy example, that sets up a specific problem And then, blam, cliffhanger. Let's go off and discuss this. You know, you have the discussion forum or for whatever technology you're using. An activity like this that's based in the real world is a great way to generate a lot of discussion. So I would see that sort of kicking around ideas, clarifying principles is one role for social media. Another, of course, is for learners to create their own content, especially if they're already in the job that you're supposed to be teaching them how to do. It's very helpful. You can say to your class, okay, is there somebody already out there who has watched a Great Dane? And, you know, or the next time you get a Great Dane, film yourself grooming it or whatever this course is about. So, and share it with the rest of us. And then we can learn from what you've done. The instructor can critique your technique possibly. So yeah, there's certainly social elements to it. Because a lot of my work is in the corporate sector and these things are delivered asynchronously, my usual clients don't include a lot of social components. I think they should, but they don't. Because, for example, to have a discussion forum, you need to have several people going through the course at the same time, ideally. But in a lot of scenarios, you have people taking these courses, for example, as they're hired. Not everybody, let's all get together and have the induction course. Is this making sense?
Kathy, a lot of people come in with already some prior knowledge and it may be all at different levels. Is it possible to do a design where people are sort of asked questions that then take them to where they need the learning rather than everybody's, you know, the empty vessel and we all need to be filled with the same thing?
Definitely. I strongly advocate for that approach, and you can do that, again, using realistic activities, starting with basic ones. And as a person with more prior knowledge, I'm acing these activities, I'm going along pretty well, and then I finally get to the point where I'm not real sure. And that's where I have to start getting in deeper into the course. If I'm brand new to the job, I can barely answer the question in the first activity. Therefore, we take the slow route through the rest of the course. So you should be able to place out if you already know the stuff. And that's another issue that some people have with e-learning is that it treats everybody as the same empty vessel and dumps the same information into every brain, whether it needs it or not. Does that answer the question?
Yes. Yep, we've just got time for one more question. Thank you.
Oops.
Just on the activity information, I'm visualizing a path of discovery through these e-learning. How can you guarantee certain points of discovery are addressed as they're going through the course? Because with discovery, some points you may discover and other points you may not. It may be critical.
So you're seeing that I may just skip over the activity about door security.
Let's say, door security, you turn it once left, three times right. They discover the left, and they miss the right.
You should have some way of capturing what they're doing in the activity to know, hey, this person's screwing up.
Oh, okay.
So, again, these aren't activities. These activities are replacing what might be like a multiple-choice quiz. So you're capturing what the learner is doing, and the feedback is saying, you're missing this. And if you have the technology, you branch them to the remedial bit on door closing. So, you're capturing their performance all the time. It's not an academic, bad term. It's not an activity that's solely to practice it in their mind. You are capturing what they're doing and using that information to send them to different places in the course. I also advocate, even though I'm very much into constructivism, I do like a really clear structure to a course, as opposed to, you may want to click over here, and then you might want to go over there, and here, there's this pop-up window over here. I totally lose it, personally, when that happens. So I like to offer learners, for example, a visual map through the course. This is the typical approach through the course. You don't have to follow it, but this is the typical one. So they at least have an idea, what do I click on next? Do we have time for one more?
We have time for maybe one more quick one.
There's one right there.
Short question?
Hi, I realize this is probably a broad area, but do you have a quick and dirty way to evaluate an online course?
To evaluate an online course? Meaning evaluate its instructional effectiveness?
Yes.
Ideally, you do more than the level one smile sheet. How did you like this course? Oh, I learned a lot. Ideally, of course, you go back to the learner in different stages farther along the road and assess them again. So you've got the short-term assessment, which I know for many of you, there's like it's been given to you and you have no choice. You do that, and then you can do more meaningful, maybe, assessments on at the workplace later on to see, has this course actually had an effect on their performance? So I would look at, you know, Kirkpatrick levels of evaluation and aim for the higher ones, which are described online if you Google Kirkpatrick evaluation. And also Will Talheimer on his site, T-H-A-L-H-E-I-M-E-R, Talheimer, Will Talheimer, has papers on his site, including one that talks about effective assessments.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Kathy. It's been a very, very interesting presentation. I think everyone's got a lot to think about. And I'd just like to give you a small token of our appreciation. And thank you. Hope you enjoy it. Thank you very much for giving us all that wonderful ideas this morning. Thank you, Kathy. If you'd like to. Now, I did mention earlier that Jennifer Newman has joined us this morning to give the welcome to country. I'm sorry she was unavoidably delayed this morning, but she's here now and has kindly agreed to give a welcome to country for us. Jennifer is a lecturer at UTS. So we really appreciate you coming down and doing this for us. Thanks very much, Jenny.
Thank you. Good morning. I think it's important just to say that I'm not going to welcome you to country. I can't welcome you to country because we're not in my country. It's about 250 miles that way. George Street's the road to my mum's house and my dad's country, Wiradjuri country. So I can't welcome you, but rather what I would do this morning is that I would acknowledge country. We're on Gadigal country. I've travelled from Wongal country this morning, down by the Cooks River, to come over here to Gadigal country to say hello to you all. My name is Jennifer Newman. I'm a Wiradjuri woman. I come here today with my old people walking with me all the time. They remind me to walk with care and respect on this good country, to think about all of the people who've gone before us and all of the people who are coming after us, and to think about this place and to walk with care and respect. We're here in between some beautiful and great places. To the west, Tumblong, Darling Harbour, Tallawalada, Long Cove, Warong, Sydney Cove, and Wonga Mulligalli, which is Farm Cove. We're here in the middle of all those good waterways. And we're here on country that very many years ago, about 221 years ago, was the site of a great teaching and learning experience. I was thinking about these two people before I came today. I was thinking about a woman, Paddy Garang, a woman known as, identified herself as Paddy Garang, a grey kangaroo, a woman known by her name that relates her to country and people and animals and spirits, her place in the earth. She met a man called Lieutenant Dawes, a man known by his rank and his family name, who'd made a very big journey, much bigger than anyone's made to come here today, I think, even those from the US. Made a very big journey and an arduous journey to come here. Paddy Garang and Lieutenant Dawes had a long friendship and they taught each other many things. One of the great gifts that we have today are the records that Lieutenant Dawes made of his conversations with Paddy Garang as he taught her to speak and read and write in English, and as she taught him to speak Eora, and she taught him the names of the country, the names of the people, the places that we belong. if you've got 5 minutes while you're here, you could run up Bridge Street to the Museum of Sydney, or stroll up Bridge Street to the Museum of Sydney, and stand in the middle of that beautiful installation by Janet Lawrence and Fiona Foley called Edge of the Trees. And if you walk amongst those 29 poles representing the 29 clans of Sydney, you can hear the place names being spoken. And if you step inside that first glass cube that's the entry to the Museum of Sydney, you can hear Paddy O'Gorang and Lieutenant Dawes conversing and exchanging, teaching and learning. It's quite a lovely thing to be able to do. The conversations between Paddy O'Gorang and Dawes, I think today, they exist almost like tweets now. We know little snippets joined together. And I often think about a much recorded, a much referenced conversation between them where Lieutenant Dawes said to Paddy O'Gorang one day, "If you would bathe more, you would become a white person." And Paddy O'Gorang said, "Tiara bara yawa, I will never become white." And I think about that conversation a lot because I think there are some tangled messages and meanings in there. I think perhaps Lieutenant Dawes didn't think that Paddy O'Gorang would become a white person, but could perhaps become more culturally and socially like a white person. And I think Paddy O'Gorang wanted to say, "I will never be like you, but I can learn and I can understand what you're doing and what you're saying." So it's a nice thing to think about being at an education conference, a teaching and learning conference, a communication conference on this good Gadigal country where 221 years ago Paddy O'Gorang and Lieutenant Dawes started teaching and learning here. I remember them. I remember all of the people who'd gone before us. So my name is Jennifer Newman. I'm a Wiradjuri woman. I live on Wangal land. I work on Gadigal land. I meet you all here on Gadigal land. And my old people are walking with me today to remind me to walk with care and respect on this good country. My old people say hello to your old people who are here with you today. And my future people will say hello to your future people when they meet each other up the road. And just as my old people remind me to walk with care and respect on this good country, and I teach my future people to walk with care and respect on everybody's country, I say enjoy this gathering, enjoy this exchange. And are we walking together with care and respect on this good country? Yeah. Thank you. It's been lovely to meet you briefly.
Thanks very much, Jenny. Thank you.